You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2026 Giro d'Italia. The cycling podcast, every day on the ground at the Giro d'Italia since 2016.
Today we are at Corno alle Scale.
Brian, buonasera. How do you say buonasera in Romanian? I'm not sure. We should ask one of these chaps. Okay. Scusa. Sai come si dice buonasera in rumeno? Buonasera. Ah, buonasera. È uguale.
Yeah, allora facile.
Yeah, we can do the rest of this podcast in Romanian then.
Yeah. Right, because we're drinking an alcohol-free Romanian beer.
Yeah.
Called Ursus.
Ursus, we know the translation of that. That's bear. And Brian, we're in a Romanian bar close to, well, the race course. We thought it was a Sardinian bar because Sardinian words have a lot of U's at the end and Romanian words also do. It's hence our mistake. We thought that's where we were, but we're not. Brian, the riders are coming down from the top of the mountain. We're standing just by the
team
buses.
They're coming round a mountain when they come.
When they come, but it's been a long time, hasn't it? It's about an hour after the finish now.
Something like
and
that.
And a lot of riders are still coming down.
Drinks are
happening
here.
We're now being offered some Romanian...
Che cos'è?
Some Romanian delicacies.
Liquore del cuore.
In liquid form. Grazie mille.
Grazie.
Cherry, some kind of cherry liqueur. Fantastic.
Awesome.
Salute. Sorry for that interruption.
There's all kinds of barbecuing
sorry,
and
sorry
drink.
Sorry for that interruption.
I'm not sorry
listeners.
About that.
The listeners can't smell what's wafting over. And lots of meat being barbecued.
This is
tough. Anyway, Brian, look, let's get back to the action. As I said, the riders are coming down, team cars are coming down. We might have to interrupt the podcast as I dive off to interview some of the direct sportifs that are arriving. Brian, before we go any further, I want to issue a mea culpa. Yesterday, I made a horrible error, I think. I haven't listened back to yesterday's podcast. I think I made a horrible error. I think Andrea Mifsud, the Maltese rider, I think I called him Misfood, which is unacceptable. And I was lying awake thinking about this last night, tossing and turning in my bed, Brian. I couldn't get to sleep. I give myself a yellow card for that. Two yellows and I'm off and I'm banned from the podcast for one match, one episode. So I'm on a yellow card, much like Johan Price-Peisersen, your countryman. He's on a yellow card as well. As is,
what's he done?
I don't know. Stage three, he got a yellow card. And Christian Scaroni as well is on a yellow card. He got a yellow card.
Just call him the Maltese Falcon then?
The Maltese Falcon, we can. But Mifsud, and I should have known that because one of my football teams is Coventry City and they used to have a Maltese striker called Michael Mifsud, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, Brian.
I thought Arsenal was your team.
One of my other teams. I was born in Coventry, so they're one of my other teams. They're just
been promoted. More than one. There you go.
Brian, we saw Vero Ciclismo, Pellacci himself saw some Vero Ciclismo. We saw him on TV late in the stage, at a key moment in the stage, actually, just when Giulio Ciccone was being caught by Jonas Vingegaard and Felix Gau. That is, well, it's not really a spoiler of what happened in the stage.
Speaking of yellow cards.
Yeah, well, we can probably spoil what happened in the stage. Most of the listeners will have seen it. Jonas Vingegaard took another stage win today, another mountain stage victory. But as we always do on the podcast, before we talk about what happened on the stage, we're going to go back to this morning. We're in Cervia on the Adriatic coast. Is it right on the coast or slightly inland? It's in that region.
It's close
anyway.
Enough to we saw water when we walked. Into town.
Pantani country, just up the road from Cesenatico. More on that later. But Brian, one of the more intriguing sort of tidbits in yesterday's podcast was about this beef, this Italian civil war we thought might have occurred between Sudal, Quicksteps, Gianmarco Garofoli and Filippo Zana. We'd seen them when they came over the line yesterday in Fermo. Garofoli's fan club were there. And it all got a bit heated and emotional. And Zana got a bit physical with his teammate. As well as verbal, and we thought that it had something to do with what happened maybe on the finishing straight as they sort of came in together, but Garofoli got slightly ahead of Zana. Anyway, Brian, all that remained for us to do was ask the respective parties, indeed, what had happened in today's stage and whether they'd cleared things up overnight. So here is Gianmarco Garofoli and Filippo Zana this morning in Cervia. the finish line, we saw your teammate Filippo Zana. He got pretty angry. We saw it seemed like he was getting angry with you. I mean, what happened?
Like in every family, sometimes you can have a discussion, but now it's all fine. We had a discussion about the race, but now we solve everything. It was just a normal discussion of the race.
Was it just what happened in the last 300 meters that you got a bit of a gap? Was that what he was upset about?
No, it was more about the whole management, the race.
But everything okay now?
Yeah, everything okay now.
It's nothing. Sometimes it's possible to we don't understand each other, and yes, but it's fine. And maybe we see the next stage to do something better, and we see. Sometimes something happens in the race, and after the race we need to explain what we do wrong, and now all is fine, and maybe we try again today and for sure in the other stage.
Your teammates with Gianmarco, are you also friends?
Yes, my teammate.
It's your teammate. Are you also friends?
Yeah, my teammates.
So, did you get in trouble yesterday for pushing him? Because we saw you after the finish line push Gianmarco into the barriers.
I just say before, sometimes something happened and I don't explain nothing more.
Brian, all very interesting. They said it was all cleared up. Also heard this morning that one explanation in the team was that they'd each had too much caffeine on today's stage. Can you know? we know that can have terrible effects. But Brian, it doesn't really matter. Maybe it's none of our business. But I'm not sure that the air was completely clear. That's just my hunch. I did learn a little bit more about what might have occurred yesterday, and it dates back to the Giro di Sardegna, the Tour of Sardinia, earlier in the year. That was their first race riding together at Sudal Quickstep. There was a stage where they finished second and fourth. They were in a four-man break, and they finished second and fourth, and apparently they weren't terribly happy with each other that day as well. So there's a bit of history in this relationship.
When in the season is the Tour of Sardinia?
Oh, it's come back. It's in February, very early on in the season.
Quite a while ago.
Yeah, and they hadn't raced together since then, but at this Giro d'Italia, they've been sort of matching each other on several stages. They're very closely matched indeed, even on general classification. And well, they said they're friends again, or Zana said we're teammates. He didn't want to say friends.
They're teammates again?
Yes, they're teammates again.
They were teammates all along. Yeah. Interesting.
So that's one to watch, I would suggest. That is one to watch. But Brian, neither of those two riders was going to be particularly prominent in today's ninth stage from Cervia to Cornale Scale. Let's find out what happened, shall we?
Il bilancio del barone. The Baron's verdict.
Well, Brian, after a brief interruption, as I had to go off and do an interview because one of the direct sportives we wanted to speak to had just arrived. Have you learned any Romanian while I've been away?
Daniel, I just finished my mystery alcohol while you were away.
Well, do you know what, Brian? I was very paranoid. I'm not going to say the direct sportive is, but I hadn't downed the whole thing, but I had had a, you know, a hearty sip, and I was very paranoid that the unfortunate
director could smell it
on my breath. Yeah. Talking of wine, alcohol, a grade for today's stage, please, in the bilancio del barone. How many wine glasses out of five, please?
Three.
That's quite parsimonious, I would suggest. Not a bad stage. Not a bad stage. Above average. Above, over halfway, anyway. Okay, Brian. Well, let's remind the listeners the situation when the race started this morning. Alfonso Eulalio still led the Giro d'Italia by 3 minutes and 15 seconds from Jonas Vingegaard and 3 minutes and 34 seconds from Felix Gau. As we've already established, the stage was from Cervia to Cornale Scale. Brian, what happened?
Today, Daniel, 8 riders went away, but with 74 kilometers to go, things started to heat up because Ulissi and Ciccone and eventually also Tornaerts went away. It took them 14 kilometers to bridge the gap up to the 8.
Should we name some of the riders? Jonas Heinz, he is from Alpecin Premier Tech. Marcellusi was also there for Bardiani, Milesi was there for Movistar, as was Einar Rubio. Tim Naberman was there for Team Picnic. Mattia Bias, that was Polti. And Zacharias Lulund-Kuller, the gentleman who earned UNOX their World Tour place last year without winning the Veneto Classic last day of the season. He was there as well. And Davide Ballerini. That was the eight. That was the initial eight. And as you said, they were soon to be joined.
Yeah, and they became 11. In the sprint in Marzabotto, our stage winner from Naples, Davide Ballerini, won. With 40 kilometers to go, their gap was around 2 minutes, and Decathlon was really pulling hard.
And the harmony in that group, Brian, well, it was a fairly harmonious group until Ciccone, Ulisi and Toon Aerts came across.
Yeah.
And then we started to see people firing off down the road, and we saw some aggravation
some
as well.
Some polemica internally in that group. Yeah. Well, eventually there was also a split in that group with 25 kilometers to go. Ciccone, Toon Aerts, Milesi, Einar Rubio and Diego Ulisi went away. Around about the same time, they were also ramping up the tempo in the peloton. This Milesi bike started to pull. In the Red Bull sprint, Einar Rubio took the points, took the money, I should say. Ciccone was second, and at this point the gap was 1 minute and 40 with 7.5 kilometers to go. Ciccone attacks, put in a blistering attack. And jumped away from Einar Rubio, who was the last man to be able to hold on.
The gap of the peloton, the gap to the peloton at this point, Brian, was 140. Around 140, 7.2 to go.
And just around at the same time, Pellizzari started to look not well.
Incidentally, Brian, earlier on in the stage, the commentators on Italian television, Rai, had noticed Giovanni Aliotti, who's his sort of guardian angel, Pellizzari's guardian angel, going back for gels to the team car, and they had sort of sussed that there was something up with Pellizzari because he'd been at the back of the group for quite a while.
Yeah, here we are. Ciccone had attacked with 7.5 seconds to go. In the favourites group, in the meanwhile, Felix Gall launched an attack, and that was followed by Jonas Vingegaard.
That was at 2.4 kilometres to go.
Yeah.
And at that point, Ciccone was 24 seconds ahead.
Call it what you like, whether it's dramatic or not. But Felix Gall was doing all the work. Vingegaard was in his wheel. With around a kilometre to go, Vingegaard attacked Gall, went away. They'd already eventually then reeled in Ciccone. Vingegaard won. Felix Gall was second.
Davide Piganzoli was third. Vingegaard hadn't even needed to use Piganzoli or Kuss.
Yeah, exactly. So it was fairly breezy day for them team-wise. Vingegaard took his second stage win.
Yeah, and well, there was a lot of there was some damage behind, and we will go over just the extent of that damage and who that damage was inflicted upon right now, because as you said, Jonas Vingegaard won the stage. 4 hours, 20 minutes it took him. Felix Gall was second. Piganzoli third. Tyrone Arensman was the best of the rest. And then an extremely good performance by the pink jersey. Alfonso Eulalio only lost 41 seconds on Jonas Vingegaard. A good performance from an improving Derek G. West as well. He was sixth, 46 seconds down. Mathis Rondel, who continues to impress, he was also 46 seconds behind Vingegaard. Sepp Kuss was able to ride his own race to a certain extent and have another good result. He was also 46 seconds behind. Not such a good day for Jai Hindley, who had looked perky, shall we say, in the last couple of days. He looked to be improving, but today lost 50 seconds. He was ninth. Michael Storer, also from Perth, incidentally, like Jai Hindley. He was 10th, also 50 seconds down.
Kind of ironic, Daniel, that Jai Hindley moves up one spot on the GC, seeing that he had a bad day. But this is all because Pellizzari had an even worse one.
And who had an even worse day than those chaps? Well, Egan Bernal, we know now that he is limited in this Giro d'Italia. He finished 17th, 1 minute and 12 seconds down. Ben O'Connor, also not such a good day for him. 18th on the same time as Bernal, 1 minute and 12 seconds. But the really big loser today was Giulio Pellizzari, who finished 22nd. 1 minute and 28 seconds down. I say that the big loser, one could argue, and people might well argue, that he actually limited his losses quite well because he was obviously on a very bad day. What does all of this do to the general classification? Well, Alfonso Eulalio's advantage has been cut, but it is still pretty handy. 2 minutes and 24 seconds. He now leads Jonas Vingegaard by. Third is Felix Gall. 2 minutes and 59 seconds adrift of Eulalio. Fourth, having gained a position on GC, as you said, Brian, is Jai Hindley, 4 minutes and 32 down. We've got Scaroni in fifth, 4:43. Aaron Simon, 6th, 5 minutes. Mathis Hondel, 5 minutes, 1 second. Ben O'Connor, 8th, 5 minutes, 3 seconds. Pelizzardi now way down in 9th place, 5:15 seconds. He's lost 3 places on GC. And Michael Storer, who's making a bit of a habit of this in Giro d'Italia, sort of loitering around the 10th place, sort of a la Zubeldia. That's where he is, 10th place, 5:20 down.
So needs to be said also that from 6th and GC to 10th, that's 20 seconds.
Yeah.
It's tight.
Not very much at all. Brian, the points competition, a quiet day on that front. Paul Manier still leads very convincingly. Also a quiet day on the mountains classification. Jonas Vingegaard still leads that and still in the blue jersey. The blue jersey that's been the subject of a lot of conversation because he's going to have to wear it in the time trial. A lot of talk about how aerodynamic it can be in the time trial, which comes after the rest day tomorrow. So Vingegaard still on top in that competition. And Eyal Alliot, of course, still on top and having extended his advantage in the white jersey competition. Now in second place is Mathis Hondel. And he's 5 minutes and 1 second behind.
That's a significant
Afonso
gap at this point.
Eh? It is. I'm sensing that Eyal Alliot can start to maybe harbour hopes of holding that jersey all the way until Rome now, although there's a hell of a long way to go, as we know. Brian, we're going to hear from a couple of people who were in the thick of the action today. Felix Gau, second place again, and a very aggressive Felix Gau. Or leader of a very aggressive Decathlon team. We're going to hear from him. And we're also going to hear from that Direct Sportif who had the misfortune of probably smelling the Romanian Amarena liqueur on my breath about 10 minutes ago. And Mark Rafe, Jonas Vingegaard's Direct Sportif. He comes second.
I'm super happy for sure to show again such a high level and to be only beaten by Jonas. The team did an incredible job again, an amazing job all day long. It's nice to have a rest day tomorrow for sure, yeah. Yeah, I was not really planning to attack myself, but then, yeah, it was the steep part wasn't, well, in the end, it felt a bit longer than it is on paper. I wanted to make sure it's really a hard final for everybody and, to try it myself. And then in the end, it worked. I mean, only beaten by Jonas, I think it's okay. Also, was a bit in the back of my head today, for sure, to have a bit of a gap before the TT. It's not exactly my strength. I was working on it a lot, for sure. I think it's more about managing it. I'm not expecting, I'm expecting to lose time on my opponents. But yeah, I hope that it's not too much.
Well, Mark, another day, another stage win. Today, were you sort of pleasantly surprised that Decathlon and a couple of other teams did as much work as they did? You didn't even have to use Piganzoli and Chris.
For us in the beginning, it was okay that the break could go to the finish. And when they were in the start already trying to take control or trying to take control of the break formation, then we already had a bit the feeling that they could do it, and they also immediately took control. I mean, they're also racing. Yeah, I think that they believe in Felix, what is also normal when you see how good he was on the blockhouse. They also race for the best possible result and also for the victory, I think, today. And that's where they went for. Yeah, was it a surprise? Yeah, a little bit, yes.
They committed so hard. Maybe yeah. People would have
used. They used almost all their riders to keep it under control. And at the moment that they were running out of guys and the gap was that close to the front, and Jonas was saying that he felt good, yeah, then we also committed to go for it.
There's this sort of narrative starting to take hold, Mark, that Jonas might even be saving himself a bit for the Tour de France. Surely no one can be leading second in a Grand Tour and saving themselves in any way, can they?
No, that's not possible. I think when you are here, you need to do everything right. You're racing against opponents, you also do the maximum possible. When he could have gone faster somewhere. I mean, you also saw it on the blockhouse that towards the end, he had a bit of difficulties to keep up the pace. Today he did a good effort, I think. It's just impossible to save yourself, especially in the end of the first week. If you are going to race then already with a break, then and to think further, that's not possible. And I also don't think that you have then the right mindset, because we are still going to face some difficult situations when you're not 100% focused. Then it's not going to work here.
And just last thing, were any of the tactics today about seeing Pellizzari at the back and probably assuming that he was having a bad day and just wanting to eliminate him.
For us, you mean? No, we wanted to try to win in the end. That was where it was about. And of course, we saw him already at a certain moment a bit towards the back. But I also said, boys, he's there in the back. Most likely he's in difficulties, or soon in difficulties, but we just stick to our plan, and that's what we did. And in the end, we could win it.
Well, Brian, 3 wine glass stage you established.
3.5.
I'm sure your countryman, Jonas Vingegaard, doesn't feel that way. It was his 50th professional win, I believe, today.
It's pretty impressive. He will be passing Rolf Sørensen as pretty short. I think he had 52. Mads Pedersen is now almost... Mads Pedersen passed Rolf Sørensen last year. So he could potentially be edging in on Mads Pedersen throughout this season. Who would have thought? It's the most winning Danish rider of all time.
Brian, is this the first polemica of the episode? Because off mic, you and I were just having the debate, and when I came back from speaking to Mark Reef, I reported that he'd sort of agreed with me that there's no way Jonas Vingegaard is saving any energy or is thinking about the Tour de France in this Giro d'Italia, although that is a storyline that has started to take hold. We were watching the Italian post-stage program, Processo alla Tappa, and it was mentioned there as well. And I've noticed a lot of people sort of suggesting this. And I feel, Brian, it's kind of their way of sort of expressing their disappointment that after today was the ninth stage, wasn't it? They sort of feel it's already over.
Are you? Okay. So
I feel that's why people are saying.
Oh,
it.
So the exercising the demons is. I think it's analysis. I mean, he would be. It would be stupid not to think about the tour if he was able to, in that sense, because he is riding the tour directly after the Giro, obviously. So my point is that if he's able to secure. Or if he's able to save energy and still win the Giro and not go deeper than he should, I think he could have gone way deeper on Blockhouse as well. And I think the way he rode today's stage proves that point to me as well, that he's not using any more energy than he should. And also rationally, wouldn't that be the smartest way to go about things? Thirdly, I know that you. I certainly also rate Mark Reef. I mean, his track record is very impressive. We don't always have to believe what sports writers say.
Oh no, of course not. Of course not, Brian. My sense is that riders always feel as though they're going to their limit. That limit, the bar, is actually quite. It's movable in the sense that Vingegaard feels as though he's going to his limit when he's up against Pogacar, and he's actually hurting himself more in those circumstances than he is currently. But he will probably feel as though he's always going to his limit, and he couldn't have gone that much harder today. But I think, you know, when we get to the last week,
I think he could have gone way harder today.
When we get to the last week, if he has a 4-minute advantage, and you know, that's maybe what we're looking at not too many days, particularly after the time trial, then I think then it becomes a legitimate theory that he is definitely, well, he takes his foot off the gas a little bit. Certainly, Visma Lisebike today didn't have to do as much as they thought they might have to. We heard Mark Reef there talk about them going for the stage win, not thinking too much about Pellizzari, not thinking too much about eliminating him. But
it's funny because Vingegaard said on TV that they weren't going for the stage
win.
Well,
they weren't going for the stage. I don't think they set out this morning to go for the stage win. But in everything they did in the last sort of 20, 30 kilometres,
right,
was very much with an eye on the stage
win. Yeah, I mean, they were obviously pulling, so for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But Decathlon did them a bit of a solid today, didn't they? And yeah, we were just speaking in the Romanian bar before we started recording to Eusebio Unthue of Movistar, the team manager, of course. And he was absolutely lost for words. Because of Decathlon tactics, yeah, today. I mean, he said, you know, put one guy up there or put two guys up there, but they went incredibly hard with the whole team from, when did we say? It was about 50 kilometres to go or more, yeah, even. Well, they pretty much controlled the whole day.
Yeah. Well, you know, we spoke about it yesterday, that it would be interesting to see how teams would manage today because of the rest day coming up. Gal spent his energy on that one attack with 7.5 kilometers to go. So he was on the wheel. It wasn't like Gal going all crazy. Gal put his team to work and then he tried to win the stage. That's how I would want to see it. It's an manageable middle part of
two,
the
2 kilometers to
two. Sorry, two and a half kilometers to go.
Yeah,
yeah, it was Ciccone who went. The energy expense on Gal's behalf is foreseeable, and Gal probably also sensed that Pellizzari was in trouble. So it was a very smart move of him.
Yeah.
So regardless of whatever they did, it was definitely an advantage that they did that to Pellizzari. So that's time won on their behalf. So I disagree with Unsue in that instance. Second of all, we have rest day coming up. The middle next part of the Giro is not the hardest one. They probably also sense that after the time trial, Vingegaard will take the jersey. It's down to them to work then. So I think from a rational perspective, it's not might not be the stupidest thing. They, of course, could not know that Pellizzari would end up in trouble today. So it's an collateral damage that they could only have hoped for. But I think the disappointment today and why they didn't get out of it what they wanted from a strategy point of view is that they wanted to go for the stage, right? And then Vingegaard spoiled that for them, and that's just too bad. But when you go hard like that, as Gal did, and Vingegaard doesn't want to do any pulls, then Gal should either have stopped pulling altogether with the risk of Pellizzari coming back.
He did. There was a point where he was looking around and said, are you going to come through, mate?
Yeah.
And Jonas said, no, mate.
So, but then at least Gal's kind of sort of limited his loss as well and kept a pretty decent pace. So it's not like Vingegaard created a massive gap. Vingegaard took those bonus seconds, but the difference is only 4 seconds in what he eventually then carved back with the bonus seconds. So yeah, I think Gal is okay after today, you know. Could have been better, but you know, it's still a good result for him.
Yeah. I never really liked this sort of post hoc analysis whereby the only barometer of whether something was a good idea or not is the final result. And if you win a stage, I remember a very famous example of this in recent history was when Bahrain, there was the stage to Col de Loz at the Tour de France. It was the 2020 Tour, and Bahrain pulled all day, very, very aggressively, I think, for Mikel Landa. And they ended up having a very bad result and with egg on their face. But, you know, if that is the only measure of success, whether you win in the end, then the only team that ever gets their tactics right is UAE or Visma Lisa by Kia.
A good example is the other day when Movistar.
Perfect example.
I mean, and I think they've got a lot more out of it than just the second place they were able to, you know, pull out with eventually. So yeah, there's a lot more to it than that. I do think it's worth touching upon the how the win of Jonas Vingegaard was perceived today, because I was listening with a half an ear to the Rai commentators, and I was listening with the other ear to the Italian Eurosport commentators today. They were not happy. They were very critical of how he didn't take any pulls, and they said it wasn't a great champion worthy. And there was sort of also in the Processo della Tappa on Rai, so the other channel afterwards, they were saying this is a modern cycling that's all about rationalizing your effort. This comes back to he's trying to win or trying to give it a go at winning the Tour after this. Whereas the Eurosport, you know, Riccardo Magrini, who I rate quite highly, he's a colorful commentator and a fun guy to listen to at times. He felt like it's someone who wants to win the Giro, who wants to be a big figure in this race, shouldn't win that way. And I was browsing through and social media, I mean, people say all kinds of stuff. There's certainly a lot of critical voices about, now he's back on the wheel of someone again. Why isn't he pulling more? If he's that strong, why is he not more generous? And so it's a kind of like it's a divisive sort of like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these are the kind of narratives we start to get when there's a very clear, favourite and a rider who's really starting to dominate, and it's halfway through the race, and people start to think, oh, God, what are we going to talk about for the last half of the race? And also, they don't really like the cut of his jib. He's not charismatic enough for them. He hasn't sort of kissed the ring enough as far as Italy is concerned and as far as giving post-race interviews is concerned, and they find him a bit impenetrable. I think that is the subtext to that narrative.
Or maybe they just wanted him to take a couple of turns with Gal.
Well, maybe, Brian, but as I said to you in the press room, the winner is always right as far as I'm concerned in professional cycling.
Yeah, I mean, Trump would agree with you with that, but I think there's more to winning the Giro. There's also conquering the Italians' hearts. I think that's quite relevant for Jonas Vingegaard as well.
They don't hand out pink jerseys for that. I agree with, well, there is a way to make me agree. If you could convince me that this is going to penalise him later in the race, that somehow Gal, Decathlon, other teams are going to exact revenge, and that is going to penalise Vingegaard. If it's part of that calculus, then I might agree with you. But I don't.
I think they can throw anything at him, and he'll still be able to respond with his legs. No, what I'm saying in a very sort of humble way, and I agree with you, is to the extent that Vingegaard is here to win the race, he's here to take stages, and he's certainly not here to take any prisoners in that sense. But I don't think it's irrelevant for Vingegaard and for Jumbo-Visma as well, and for their sponsors and all this and all that, that he's a popular rider. I don't think that's irrelevant.
Yeah, I don't know whether taking two pulls on Cornelis Scali is really going to make that much difference. But
go and have a look at the comments on social media. Go and look at, let's see what the next weeks will bring on that scale.
Okay. We should praise the performance of the pink jersey today, Afonso Eulalio, who we knew was a very good climber, but we didn't really expect him to be this close to the best riders, I don't think, on a mountain stage. Fifth today, just 41 seconds down. And, well, the Bahrain staff told us, after he took the pink jersey in Potenza, that their hope, their dream almost, was that he got to the time trial with the pink jersey. And he's done that with a very handsome margin. So handsome, in fact, that in spite of what we said about him being a pretty mediocre, to say the least, time trialist, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that he could get close to keeping that pink jersey. Brian, if you add in for sort of pink jersey, whatever the pink jersey tax rebates, the advantage you get from wearing a leader's jersey, we've seen this have a huge sort of galvanizing effect on riders before. If you ascribe sort of 1 minute or a minute and a half to that, because I think ballpark, based on past performances, he might lose 4 minutes to Vingegaard in the time trial of that distance. If you say he's gonna derive a minute's advantage, or a minute and a half's advantage from wearing the pink jersey, who knows, Brian?
I think the time trial is too long for giving that type of, adding that type of leader's jersey thrill.
Everyone's so worried about this blue skin suit that Jonas is going to have to wear. They're talking about it as though it's like a Parker jacket that he's going to, like the one you're wearing, that he's going to have
to ride. I'm not wearing a Parker jacket. What are you wearing? This is a field jacket.
And he's going to have to ride the time trial in, although maybe more on that later, because I've heard all sorts of stories about Jonas Vingegaard dummy having been created by Visma Lisa Bike and deployed to lessen the disadvantage that he'll suffer in a few days.
Well, I mean, the pink jersey skin suit that Eulalio is wearing is provided by the same supplier, so doesn't really bear any relevance.
No. One thing I did want to mention, and this was sort of served to me on a plate by Pellacci, who was on the climb today, was also, well, he was allegedly slightly inebriated. He was also on Italian TV. We saw him. Maybe we've already mentioned that in the podcast. There's certainly a picture of him. We put the screenshot on the Cycling Podcast Instagram. But Pellacci, I can't remember which of the many platforms he uses, he put this on, but he went through Vergato, which was a little village on the way, sort of at the bottom of the final climb. And he learned today that this was the home village of Alfonso Calzolari, the winner of 1914 Giro d'Italia, one of the most Monty Python-esque Giro d'Italia. All sorts of things happened there, all sorts went on. It was the Giro with the longest stage ever, the lowest average speed for the winner, 23.3 kilometers an hour. I think you're right, could possibly have finished on the podium. But also, Alfonso Calzolari, I'm pretty sure, was the first rider ever to win a Grand Tour with some sort of reprieve, as the Italians say, a tavolino, so it was sort of decided afterwards. Why? Because he got a 3-hour penalty for holding on to a car all the way up a climb, La Salita delle Svolte, which I think is near Pescara or Aquila, somewhere in Abruzzo. The Italian sort of cycling union asked for him, or wanted him, to be disqualified. He was disqualified, But then in February of the following year, 1915, a tribunal upheld his appeal, or upheld a sort of protest, and he was crowned the winner of the 1914 Giro d'Italia. And then the next year, the First World War broke out in Italy, or the Italians became involved in the First World War, and that sort of, it halted his momentum somewhat. So there you go. 23 kilometres now, Brian. Maybe there's hope for us yet. Anything else to mention before we go to the chiacchierata del giorno? Anything else you'd like to talk about? Pellizzari, we're not entirely sure what went wrong yet. I guess we'll find out, but worrying signs for him.
Yeah. The interesting thing is now to see what the dynamic will be with Bora. Eventually, they will have to give Jai Hindley a run for the podium now.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they need to do.
Yeah. I saw a great quote from Jai Hindley this morning about Felix Gau, talking about if he widens his legs, his knees anymore on his bike, then it will be impossible to attack him because he'll block the entire road.
Ouch.
Yeah, he's good for a zinger. He's quite reticent, Jai Hindley, in interviews. He doesn't give interviews after the finish line, almost never. I mean, I joke with him about it. I say, Jai, can you give me two tokens that I can use for post-race interviews in this Giro d'Italia? And he hasn't even agreed to that yet.
Remember when he won the Giro and then in the post-podium press conference? He has like these one-liners, and often he'll bring like analogies and wordplays that I haven't heard before. And he said that when he won in Verona, he said, yeah, we didn't come to put sneakers on centipedes.
Yeah.
And that was an expression, an Australian expression I'd never heard before.
No, part of me thinks he goes back to his room in the evening and sort of studies for several hours.
Yet he doesn't give any interviews. So no,
concocts these wonderful...
keeps them for special occasions.
Yeah, these wonderful one-liners. Speaking of Australians, the victim of today's Chiacchierata del Giorno is an Australian. Tomorrow, we've got a Kilometre Zero episode coming out, and I've called it the Dukes of Hazzard. Also, the subtitle is whatever the Dukes of Hazzard was in Spanish. I did look that up earlier, but I haven't got it at the front of mind. But anyway, the Dukes of Hazzard, why? Because Max Chandri and Matt White, both of whom have featured a lot on the cycling podcast, particularly the Giro over the years, they're in the Movistar team car together at this Giro d'Italia. So that Kilometre Zero is about them, their relationship, what they're doing here at the Giro d'Italia. But I know people like listening to Matt White. He's always got a good yarn, Brian. And today, at the start, we were in Cervia, very much Pantani land. And Matt White, of course, was a rider in the Pantani era. And I just knew that Matt would have a Pantani story or two. Hence, I went in search of Matt White this morning. And he is the victim of today's
La chiacchierata del giorno, the chin wag of the day.
You got any Pantani stories?
Well, I have got lots of Pantani stories.
Go on, let's because we're in his neck of the woods.
More so around when I was in my first year in 1998, when he won the stage. I think it was like stage 19, won a massive epic stage in the Dolomites. I was eliminated in a group of about...
Oh, we've talked about this before, haven't
yes.
we?
Yeah, all I remember is, I don't remember too much from the stage because I was just scrambling to make, and I think more than 40 of us got eliminated with 2 days to go, including five of my teammates and including Bartley, who was in the sprint jersey. And those days, obviously, there was no internet. And so we had to wait for the paper communique. We had dinner, massage, everything. We missed it by under a minute or something. That was his first win in the Giro, Pantani. And then I was actually looking back today.
First time you took the pink jersey, wasn't it?
Yes, in 98. And then we're looking this morning, because I remember the name of this climb, and it hasn't been run since 2004. Yeah. It was very, very different, because it was stage three. Yeah. Brad McGee was in the Maglia Rosa. He'd won the prologue in Genoa. Yeah. And Simone won the stage. But all I remember from that race was the drama between Kunigo and Simone.
Yep.
Same teammates going head to head with each other, and I can't remember one. I think it was Simone. I think Kunigo was attacked Simone while he's in the Maglia Rosa.
Yeah. So Simone went on the Cornale Scale stage three.
He won today's stage, yes.
And then a couple of days later in the Mercogliano di Montevergine, remember they had the steel, Steel My Cannondale. They had the black and white stripy jersey. Kunigo won there.
Yep.
Then they sent him. Falters in the Dolomites, well, not quite in the Dolomites. They sent Kunigo down the road, 50k from the finish,
yep.
And Simone couldn't chase him, and then that's where Kunigo got the time.
Yeah, I remember bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces.
Max wouldn't remember this, would he, based on the conversation the other day?
Oh, come on, don't be harsh there, mate. No, I don't remember. Bits. I was in the race, but I wasn't focusing so much on the climbing stages.
Going back to the 98, I remember a couple of things stand out. What you told me about that, yep. Giro, you reminded me there were no rest days in that Giro.
It was the last one. We started in Nice, prologue up and down the old Esplanade, and then straight, it was immediately real tough stage, inland, I can't remember, it went straight up into climbs, like within
three. San Remo style stage, I think.
And I remember suffering straight away. It was really hard stage one. And then I think it was just basically just for logistics for the race, that, you know, it linked up okay, and what do they need a rest day? And so the UCI then made it mandatory to have one rest day. So we had a one rest day from the Tour de France and the Vuelta were having rest days anyway, but that Giro, lo and behold, they didn't want a rest day. And then about five years later, I can't remember exactly when, there was the second rest day came in. Yeah. But yeah, 90, my first Giro was, and I didn't make it to the finish. I think it was 18 days in a row. I was quite green.
Riding for Fanini,
Amorevita. Amorevita. Forza Corps, which was Berlusconi's political party with the major sponsor, amongst 20 others. And I remember very well having the... I went to Catholic school as well. We had our photos.
Oh, you can tell.
We and Boy Scouts. Yeah. We had our photos on the steps of the Vatican with Padre Pio II. So that photo stands very proud in my parents' house. After 15 years of Catholic schooling, I got to meet the Pope. Mm. People think it's photoshopped, but it certainly is not.
Bloody Pantani rode you at the time limit in your first year. That wasn't very charitable, was it?
No, and I remember really well because the technology wasn't the same. That people were getting time checks from Swannies and whatever, like on the last climb before we descended down. And then someone got the word, we need to get a wriggle on here. And some people could and some people couldn't. And there wasn't the rule then either that, you know, a certain percentage of the bunch. Remember, there was a rule there, if you were 30% of the bunch, you could miss the time cut and they'd still keep you in.
You weren't in that. There was a Tirreno around about that time where Castellano kicked everyone out. There was 80, but who were outside the time limit?
I was not, because I would have remembered that. I was not riding. That was my era, but I must have been at Paris-Nice, unfortunately.
And then I also remember you telling me about you drove home the next morning to Tuscany, is that
right? Yes, yeah, I was living at the Fanini, back at the back of Fanini's shop with five amateurs and one other professional. We drove the next morning and I just remember, I don't know how far it would have been to Lucca, or Lunata, from deep in the Dolomites, but all I remember was a very painful trip in the car. And I was that, you know, I had mixed emotions because it was obviously, I was upset that I didn't get to finish my first Giro, make it, you know, within 48 hours of the finish. But I was so distraught, like so wrecked, it didn't bother me. And then actually, I got on a flight, I think 48 hours later, and flew back to Australia to see my partner at the time. So it was a crazy time, but good memories.
So we've loosely, we've shoehorned in Pantani, which is good, Matt. The last few days, we've seen Milesi seems to be going really well. Enric's not had such a good time the last couple of days, but how are things?
Yeah, good, mate. Every Grand Tour, it's like a roller coaster, isn't it? And you just got to pick and choose your moments, ride the roller coaster and make the most of the resources that you've got. So, no, we've had a good first week, a couple of close calls, and we're far from finished.
Close calls as in close, you've close almost call, won.
Yeah, we were second on the stage. Yeah. I think we did everything right. Fourth on a stage with Milesi. Yesterday, we had three guys in the break, fifth and eighth. And, you know, really, for the climbers, yesterday, I think the Malia Rose group was 19 riders on a stage that, you know, wasn't that hard, really. But what's that show? A show there's a lot of tired legs. And I think the key for any team in the back end of this race is getting, one, healthy riders, which not everyone's healthy in most of the teams. You know, we've had some pretty rough conditions. A lot of travel, some pretty harsh conditions. Mm. It's spring, and if you've got a healthy team going into the back end of this race, and especially one that's based around climbing, I think there's a lot of opportunities. If you look at the way that the lay of the land with GC and the gaps that have formed already and that will form in the next 48 hours, I think there's going to be a lot to play for certain teams.
Well, the big boss has arrived. Eusebio's arrived. He's looking suave and unruffled, as always, anyway. So that's a good sign. And we're just waiting for Max to do this photo shoot for the episode coming out tomorrow. Matt, you and Max, the Dukes of Hazzard.
It's the first time the Dukes of Hazzard have been put together. And all good. All good.
Still 8 days in.
Hey.
Brian, you've pandered to my musical taste slightly today, having established that you're not a big fan of The Boss, Bruce Springsteen. You have,
I like some of his stuff. I like some of his stuff. I like Nebraska, the album, and I actually quite like this album as well, Tunnel of Love. Remember hearing it for the first time when it just came out. I was a very young man. I was a young boy back then. I quite like this album, I have to admit.
Well, Brian, the cue for this today was me listening to Vasco Rossi this morning in the car on the drive to Cervia. And why was I listening to Vasco Rossi? Well, I generally enjoy Vasco Rossi, but today is the musical stage of the Giro d'Italia, classic stage across where the musical heartlands. And I'm not just talking about pop music, I'm also talking about where Pavarotti's from, Emilia Romagna, if music, popular music and other kind of music, has a sort of heartland in Italy. It is this strip across, not quite the middle, is it? It's a bit higher than the middle, but Emilia Romagna, who can we name from there off the top of our head? Vasco Rossi, rock music, popular music. He's a bit of a sort of, maybe it's insulting Bruce Springsteen a little bit to call him the Bruce Springsteen of Italy.
Bruce Springsteen of Italy, that would make sense.
The sort of gravelly voiced, popular, kind of troubadour of the common people in Italy, I would say.
Yeah.
The blue collar icon of Italian music. So Ligabue in a relatively similar vein, Laura Pausini, Lucio Dalla, all these. I mean, these might not be particularly famous or familiar names to an English speaking public, but rest assured they're some of the titans of Italian popular music in the last 50 years, aren't they? And Vasco Rossi from Modena, from the hills above Modena, and the race not exactly going right past there, but not too far. And Brian, last night you mentioned in the presentation of today's stage that the peloton began through Sasso Marconi, which is a place that it's not a big place, just south of Bologna, south and west of Bologna.
It's the next exit for us.
Next exit for us. But it crops up a lot in whether it's literature or songs as well. And I certainly had memories of hearing it mentioned, name checked a lot in songs, and there's one song in particular, Bomba o Non Bomba.
It's one of my favorite, almost my favorite Italian song.
Well, let's just see if we can. I mean, we'll probably get sued for this, Brian, but I'm gonna play a little bit of it, see if people can hear this.
The live version.
What? E bomba non bomba, noi arriveremo a Roma, malgrado voi, a Sasso Marconi. Heard him there, arriviamo a Roma, arriveremo a Roma, we'll get to Rome. And what's this about? Well, it's to the person who wrote the song is Antonello.
It's based on a novel, isn't it?
Antonello Venditti, I'm not sure. It's about his partnership, his friendship with another musician, Francesco De Gregori, and about their efforts.
Two journeymen,
touring and trying to get to Rome via, and there are various other locations that I mentioned.
It's almost like their Giro d'Italia, isn't it?
It is, and this is sort of set, it was written, the song came out in 1978, and the backdrop and the sort of subtext, if it is a kind of metaphor, is that Italy in those years is what they call in Italy the anni di piombo, the lead, the years of lead. Why they called that? Because there was an awful lot of unrest in Italy in those years, particularly domestic tourism.
Terrorism.
So the song's a bit of a metaphor for having to overcome a lot of sort of hurdles and obstacles in order to get to the final destination.
Can I just also say that there's a remastered version on your normal streaming music channels, which is a bit more cleaner than the YouTube version than the Daniel feature here.
The YouTube version coming out of my laptop, balanced on my lap, and as we make our way around the Bologna Ring Road. Anyway, Brian, that's Sasso Marconi, which is on the route today, shortly before the start of the final climb.
Dolce sarà la strada, as they sing. Sweet be the road. Thank you.
Brian, that was us on our drive today through Emilia-Romagna into the Apennines, talking about the musical heritage of this part of Italy. Yet again, it's becoming a common theme, and we know that Pellacci's somewhere sort of in our midst or in the midst of the Giro d'Italia. We never know exactly where. We didn't know exactly where, and so we tore it until we saw him on our TV screen this afternoon. What a sight that was in his black lycra, screaming with his fist clenched, gurning at Felix Kau and Jonas Vingegaard. Anyway, actually, how did he get up there? We don't really know. He must have ridden up there. But what else was he doing today? Well, he thought he'd tell us, or at least give us a little bit of a vignette from his day on the mountain or going to the mountain.
No, spiegami.
Quello da parte di là, moda così, è fatto solo collardo, aglio e aglio rosmarino.
Ok.
Questo invece è pancetta, aglio rosmarino e formaggio.
Ma spiegami un po', Borlengo, Zampa...
Nella, Zampanella.
Come mai?
È la stessa. Ah, che ne so.
Daniele, Barone, where are we, chaps? We're in Chalet delle Terme di Porretta. It's mountain hot. Just 300 meters after the finish line. Porretta Terme, of course, is a thermal station here close to Villiciatico, Poggiolforato, all the places that are surrounding the Corno alle Scale finish of today. I just biked up here and it's cold, it's windy, it's pure Giro d'Italia conditions. We've got super steep final, the last 2.5k are incredibly steep, but we are in Emilia, we are in the land of velociclismo. Percentages and gradients are super high, but you've got Tigelle, Lambrusco, you've got the best wine and the best food, of course. And I was talking to some guys here at the mountain hut, and they were making a local dish. It's more like crepe, but more crispy, thinner, and crispier. And it's called Borlenghi or Zampanelle, just two different, completely different names. A bit like torta fritta and gnocco fritto. Basically, every little village has their own name here for things. Listen, you have to love Emilia at the Giro d'Italia. I can't wait to see some vero ciclismo today.
Vero ciclismo, said Pellacci today. That was before the race, so God knows what he said, what he would have said afterwards. And Pellacci, of course, is back with us from Tuesday, so from the time trial, and he's with us until the end, until I kick him out of the car.
Should I be on standby?
Yeah, definitely. Got a listener question. Good listener question. Peter Newland asks us, you spoke with John Foote about the problems of over-tourism in the most well-known areas of Italy. Which lesser-known parts of the country would you recommend vacationing in for good food, wine, cycling, but also where tourist euros can still be a boon to the local community rather than a burden? Is Le Marche the conscious travellers of Tuscany, or is that too simplistic? Well, we were in Le Marche last night. I mean, every time we go there, we talked about it in yesterday's podcast, didn't we? The light quality, the rolling hills, the hilltop towns. But I said when we were driving to the start today, Brian, I had a holiday in Le Marche a couple of years ago. And if you go out of season, if you go and by out of season, I even mean May or June, you might find a lot of those towns, those beautiful hilltop towns, are pretty dead. And that can be a bit sad, to be honest.
Yeah.
When you're used to Tuscany. I think Umbria is still a great bet, to be honest.
Yep. Well, for me, it really depends on what time of year you go.
Yeah.
And I think, and I know you disagree, Sicily has a lot to offer depending on where in Sicily you go and where. Yeah, and also when. So I would definitely highlight Ortigia, which is the peninsula off of Siracusa. Amazing history, fantastic food, great coastline.
But it's good for an afternoon. You can walk around it in an hour.
No, no, as a place to stay, but it also is close enough to go up to Etna for an excursion.
You want to get blown up, covered in molten ash. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, you'll be fine. And if any of our listeners would be interested in a more specific itinerary, they can always contact me directly. And there are the Aeolian Islands off the north coast of Sicily. You'll have to either take a boat from Messina or Palermo. I would probably mostly recommend Salina.
And if you want to see a film, an excellent film in which they feature Caro Diario, Dear Diary, and Nanni Moretti film, a fantastic film in which those islands, yeah, are, well, of which they are a big part.
I agree with you, Umbria, but I also think, you know, Tuscany is very vast.
Yeah.
There's certainly also places in Tuscany where you don't necessarily find that many tourists. And I think if you go September, October, the area around Chianti, actually during harvest, is fairly quiet, I find. And you can definitely also still see rather local life,
yeah,
I find.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily hit the beaches sort of around July, August. But if, let's say, if you go to Isla d'Elba in September, if you go to Sardinia in September, as soon as the Italians start their normal sort of everyday life, which is when the schools start in the middle of September, I think those, some of those more touristy places, you haven't pretty much to yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I would say Friuli is very underrated. There's
definitely
a lot in Friuli that's very underrated, from the food to the wine to the landscapes as well. That's the northeasternmost region. And when we, I usually go almost every year to the mountains in Italy on holiday. I generally go to Südtirol or the Alto Adige, the German-speaking part of Italy. Now, the Dolomites have become a bit of a magnet for Instagrammers, and this has become a huge talking point in Italy, the over-tourism in the Dolomites, and people are very worried about it. Reinhold Messner, the legendary mountaineer, he's become a very prominent voice in how to combat the over-tourism, but I would still recommend that anyone who loves the mountains goes up there. But I would stay to the west of Bolzano, and it's not really it's not the Dolomites, but as soon as you get east of Bolzano into the real Dolomites, then it particularly from June onwards, it gets extremely, extremely busy. And I just think it's a shame in places of such grandiose natural beauty to see over tourism. And because that's really why you go there, to get away from things. And it's very difficult to get away from people, particularly in the Dolomites as we sort of know them, the places like Cortina, Corvada, etc. So they'd be our hot tips for Brian. We could talk about this for hours, couldn't we? And there's not been that much ciclismo in this part yet, so we should probably rectify that now.
La tappa di domani, la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, last night's dinner, you didn't have a particularly good time. Should we gloss over? Do you want to gloss over it?
I had a good enough time. It's just I'm not great with like noisy crowds. I don't mind them at a bike race. It's kind of part of why we're here, isn't it? But a loud restaurant is probably one of my least favorite things.
Yeah, it was quite loud. It was
really loud.
You know. And some natural wine, which you didn't particularly enjoy either. But Brian, do we want to give the menu from last night? Tell anyone about what
remember.
We. I've got. Well, really I've got it. I've got it on a WhatsApp. What did we have? What did we have? We had gnocchi with a pesto of courgettes, pomodorini, little tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, and salted ricotta. Brian, you suspected there was garlic in there, and the waiter assured us that there was none. Anyway, there was some guinea fowl as well, and which is common in Italy. You find that in a lot of restaurants in Italy. I thought it was pretty good, but anyway, Brian, different region tonight, different cuisine in Tuscany.
We're heading home, aren't we?
Yeah, if we manage to get there on time. Anyway, and we'll still be in Tuscany on Tuesday for the keenly anticipated time trial, Brian. Now, Felix Gall versus Jonas Vingegaard is going to be one of the big storylines. Felix Gall is a sort of chronically kind of maligned time trialist, or maligned for his lack of time trialing ability. I was speaking to his team the other day, Seb Joly of Decathlon. He said that he's got a slightly different position this year. He's even a bit higher on the bike. I mean, he looks pretty high on his road bike, but higher than he used to be on his time trial bike. But they've got him sort of better tucked in the bars, and they think that he's made some improvement. Brian, the best analogue that I could find in terms of the length of the time trial, because just remind us, how long is the time trial?
42 kilometres.
And it's completely flat?
Yes. It is like literally along
completely
the beach.
Flat. So 42 kilometres. They haven't ridden against each other in that many long time trials. We don't get that many long time trials nowadays in bike races. But the best analogue I could find was the Tour de France last year, Caen to Caen, 33 kilometres, and Jonas Vingegaard finished 1:21 behind the stage winner, who's Remco Evenepoel, And Felix Gau finished 3:06. So that was about 1:40. However, caveat, little asterisk, that was the day where Jonas Vingegaard had a terrible time trial.
He did.
And he was pretty miserable afterwards. So maybe not such a good gauge of what they're likely to do.
But I think we also need to take into consideration that Decathlon as a whole, as a team, have taken a massive step up on their technical side. It's not the team it was last year, in so many words. Speaking of, when we were waiting for the riders and the sports directors' cars to come back here, I saw one of my old colleagues from my time at Jake, was now called Jake Walula Greenwich at the time, Mark Quad, who's there now, senior sports scientist. And I would actually credit him with a lot of the positive changes that have happened there on the technical side. And whenever he steps in and puts his knowledge and energy into projects like that, good things and advantages come out the other end. So I'm a bit more optimistic than just the statistic difference that we'll see. I think Gaal will ride his best time trial so far, because he has all the motivation. Like he's riding for GC at the Giro, and he'll have a great chance of putting in some time to some of his most immediate rivals. So I don't think he'll completely make an embarrassment out of himself. I think he'll ride his best TT so far.
Okay, Brian, imagine you're Felix Gaal. Imagine you currently reside in Salzburg, for the sake of argument. That's where he does currently reside, we were told the other day.
Great place to ride your bike.
Imagine the hills are alive with the sound of music, Brian. Someone offers you 2 minutes, a 2 minute deficit from Jonas Vingegaard in that time trial. You sign, don't you? You sign immediately. You don't even let them reach into their pocket for the pen.
It's kind of like it's there and thereabouts. If it was like 150, it was like
I think you snap the hand off for two.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was going to say, I thought we might get to three. I thought you might even sign for three.
Yep, it is a good point. It is. I mean, 42 kilometers, that's a long old time trial in these days and times, isn't it? We rarely go above 35 anymore.
No.
So yeah, you're probably right. He should have sold it for two. You're right.
Yeah, I think anything under 2.5 is pretty damn good for Felix Gau. And we won't talk too much about the blue jersey and their concerns, if there are any concerns about the blue jersey and whether it's going to be aerodynamic enough. Yeah, I mean,
things were close. And also when you think of the every other technical advantage that that Visma-Lisa bike have, and I know that all the teams have stepped up, all the GC teams have stepped up in a lot of ways, but I think they will still be the cutting edge reference here, at least for the ones that are you know in the mix for the GC.
Yeah. Anyway, Brian, we'll be back on
Wednesday.
Tuesday. In the meantime,
we'll also be back on Wednesday.
Yep. In the meantime, Kilometer Zero tomorrow, Dukes of Hazzard. I think I'm going to put it on the general feed, not behind the paywall, so everyone can listen to that. Also, just one last thing I haven't mentioned so far in this Giro d'Italia, our friends from Amara Terra, who provide our excellent music, various different tracks that we use throughout the Giro d'Italia. So thank you to them. Also, haven't mentioned for a few days at least, Greg Andrews, Divine Cellars. Greg is still offering our Giro Vagando case of wine, which beautifully showcases the terroir of this Giro d'Italia in wine form, case of wine. So if you're interested in that, go to his website, their website, divinecellars.com. That's the letter D, Vine Cellars, all one word, .com. And you'll find the cycling podcast cases on there, including our 2026 Giro Vagando case. Brian, see you on Tuesday.
Thank you for listening. Buonasera.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burnett.